Okay, I'd like to welcome everyone here this evening for our 4:30 study session meeting. I believe that since our mayor is not here, we need to make a motion to appoint someone to lead the meeting.
I'll move that we appoint Mrs. Johnson as our mayor pro tem for this meeting and for city council meeting.
I'll second.
Question, do we need to have that extend until the mayor gets back, or she stays the mayor pro tem, or just for the meetings?
Just for the meetings.
Okay.
She'll be back this evening.
Okay.
And I will gladly give her back her seat.
Good.
So if there's a second, all in favor?
Aye.
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 Aye. Okay, we'll start out with our invocation by Council Member Don Shelton.
Dear Heavenly Father, we come before Thee this evening and thank Thee for our great blessings. We're thankful for these comfortable and safe circumstances that we have to meet in. We're thankful for the blessing of participating in our government. We're thankful for the responsibility that we have and the stewardship to care for the residents of this city and those who are employed here. We pray that Thy Spirit will be with us this evening and guide us and help us to be wise and to make good choices that will bless those who are involved. We love the Heavenly Father and ask these things in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen. Thank you. Okay, I guess we're now to C with the council coordination. So are there any items on the agenda for our meeting that you have concerns about?
Well, for coordination, tomorrow we have the, what is it? Utah League of Cities and Towns, Youth
Local
Council Day?
Local Officials
Day. Local Official Day. I'll be joining for the lunch portion. I don't know.
What I'm not
you're
attending.
You're not attending this year. Were you?
I think I'll go. What's on the agenda in the morning?
I don't know because I had other meetings, so I'm
going
to be there for the lunch.
I have a couple of meetings involving some legislative strategy stuff, so I don't know the general stuff, but I can look it up in the meeting, make sure you guys have a copy. Okay.
There is an LPC, though, I think. Isn't that after lunch?
I thought it was at 11.
Is it 11?
I'd have to look, because they've asked me to come to a meeting, I think, at 10 or 10:30, and then we have our
daily update. I have LPC on my calendar, too. So.
Is there any voting meetings where we need people there to vote?
I don't think so.
Anything it would be so. Just LPC members?
Probably just be mostly information. I don't think they have anything to take a vote on.
Yeah, I think we'll just be informative tomorrow.
Nothing that they've sent out or discussed in the last LPC. We were there and they didn't have anything of pressing issue for a vote.
Still
so
waiting to
see what
bills are coming
in. Is there a link to join in on that?
I can find, see
I
if
could
they
be available at 11.
I can see what they have and I'll send you whatever they've got.
Great.
I'm not sure if that's in the ballroom or during lunch or in one of the side rooms, but I'll see what I can find.
It seems
Thank
like
you.
I saw that there was some kind of meeting rather for the adults rather than the youth council before.
Yeah, I think that's part of the LPC meeting.
Yeah, and I thought it was 11. I'll double check. I'll get you everything.
And then as a reminder, Thursday night, Mountain Creek Middle is hosting the Chinese New Year event in combination with many of the other schools in the area.
Anything else? Anything on the agenda?
Bless you.
It looks pretty light.
Yeah, we'll have the conservation program update from Connor. Kind of fill you in on where we've been on that over the last year. And then we have a franchise agreement that Don Tingey will walk you through. And that's it tonight.
Okay. Then I guess we can move on to the historical preservation discussion.
Just one note, right on time for the agenda, 4:45. Good job.
Plus pizza.
More time for dinner.
More time for you, Don.
There.
Like, literally, we can see you better.
It's easier to see an area.
Okay.
I have heard the secret.
That's an awfully daunting chair.
Only people named Don can sit there.
Don, want to switch with me?
No. I'm quite comfortable.
It's the Don chair.
This is the mayor's chair, not. So.
I'm going to send somebody a picture.
Yeah, not that presumptuous, that's for sure. Okay. Well, we have a few historic preservation items wanted to come and talk with the council about. A couple of them are to kind of make you aware of things that have happened and some of recommended changes. And if we kind of get your nod, then we'll put things in motion. And then like to talk a little bit about Aunt Mames. It kind of all leads to Aunt Mames as well, and get some direction there. So, So start with, I'm not sure if you know what the Certified Local Government Grant Program is, but it's a grant program run through the state of Utah, through the Historic Department of the State of Utah, using National Historic Preservation Funds. And they pass through grants on an annual basis for communities that have historic preservation projects. And we probably received 50,000-ish, if I remember right, on Aunt Mames at the time we were doing the restoration in Aunt Mames. This last year we were, and we'll talk a little bit more about this as we talk with Aunt Mames, this last year we had prepared a grant application for the Salt Lake County TRCC grant, and we were going to match a certified local government grant with it. And as we started talking with the state of Utah, we realized that we needed to recertify our local government status. And as it would be in recertifying, the federal government national parks was looking at our city code, and our code wasn't compliant. So they asked us to change our code, which entails adding the word, literally the word district, in our code to go along with district, sites, and facilities. And so
it's an important word.
It's an important word. And they've systematically been doing this with the state as communities have been needing to recertify. Spanish Fork did, for instance, Spanish Fork did theirs last year. So as we got with the attorney's office and started.
Should let Elon Musk know about that.
We should. For a $10,000, that's the other thing. The certified local government grants, they're a maximum of $10,000 a year, and they're a 50-50 match. So big time money, you know.
For what time period?
For.
Well, you said it's $10,000 a year.
They do the grant cycle once a year, and typically they do urban cities 1 year and rural cities the next year. It kind of depends on how much money is available and what your projects are. Like when we did the Aunt Mames project, we actually did get money on a 3-4 year, 5 year process. It's because the money was available and there wasn't a lot of projects being requested. So
you have to reapply each year.
So each year, a specific grant. So like at Aunt Mames, we did the roof was one project and the windows was another project. And we just applied that $10,000 towards the larger project at the time.
How much have we spent on Aunt Mames so far, year to date?
The home, it was about $1.5 million for the seismic retrofitting and the out in the exterior restoration. We haven't done anything on the inside.
A lot of money.
Yeah, the park was about $2 million.
That's why the family wanted to work with us.
Anyway, so back to CLG. Back in the day when the CLG was put, the process was put into our city code, it was, we realized it was actually put into Title 17, which requires a lot of, it requires us to go through the Planning Commission for any changes. As you're aware, we've done some changes with city commissions and boards and put those, and specifically the Historic Preservation Committee, and put those changes in title, in Chapter 2, so that there's those requirements with the boards are with the boards. And that's where the Historic Preservation Committee is. And so as we started looking at it, we thought it might be appropriate to move the CLG language out of Title 17 and put it in Title 2 along with the Historic Preservation responsibilities that that committee's with their bylaws. And then there's some, the state and the national parks has some pretty specific requirements on things that we do with for historic preservation, like inventorying and what, you know, that. And so we thought it would just be, rather than working out of both sides of the code, we just put all these requirements right with code. So if you're in agreeance with that, we'll start that process with a with an ordinance change for the word district, as well as the ordinance change to move it from Title 17 to Title 2, and it will require us going to the Planning Commission before we bring it to you, and then we'll, and then when you get it, you'll get the ordinance plus the resolution moving all these requirements to the historical committee.
So nothing's really going to be changed. It's just an organization.
The only, it's just organization. The word district, there's no intent to create a district, but the Fed, but the National Park Service is requiring district be put in into the code in order for us to get money. So,
so what? Why was it with the Planning Commission to begin with?
That's a good question. 1987 was when that was put in there. So I, long before any of us were here.
And what? What's the? What's the practical functioning of it being with the Planning Commission? I mean,
in talking with Stephen a little bit, he wonders that in a larger city like Salt Lake City, and the Planning Commission gets involved in a lot heavier into some of these restoration projects, that they wanted more control from the Planning Commission side of a project, whether it's a district project or a single site project.
So we just kind of followed their lead.
So
maybe.
So at the time, the city attorney just put it in Title 17. We were a totally different city in 1987.
Of course. So what changes if we take it out of there? I mean, if
all the language stays the same, it just is in Title 2, not Title 17.
But before, if we did something with historical, with Aunt Mames, for example, say we're doing some roof restoration, does that have to go to the Planning Commission for a vote?
It
is now?
No. Stephen might. I don't know the rules of the Planning Commission as well as Stephen does, but my understanding is no. And
so when I discussed this with Dawn, I speculated that part of the reason it was in Title 17 is a lot of cities treat historic preservation like they would any other zoning land use ordinance. So if you're within a district like Harvard, Yale, and Salt Lake City, right, and you come in to renovate your home, there would be additional requirements potentially for your home depending on how it's classified and all of that. Because the sites in South Jordan are so few, there isn't necessarily that need to have that land use component to it. And reading through the ordinance, there's no real land use requirements. So, for example, what you brought up, this idea that if you change the roof that there would be some oversight from the Planning Commission. There's nothing like that included in the ordinance.
So it's not happening now anyway.
No, there's no like trigger to take it before the Planning Commission. There's no trigger really at a staff level for any review. It all was set up for the committee, right? And there's no reason why it needs to be a planning function versus just a city function like it is with all the other boards and commissions that we have in the city. It just, the role is different than, as Don stated, you would have in potentially other cities. The reason it has to go to the Planning Commission is because anything in Title 16 or 17 under state law is a land use regulation, and therefore you have to have Planning Commission recommendation to the City Council before the City Council decides whether or not to change the law. As we get into the details, there may be a few little nuggets that are left in Title 17 that may arise. We haven't quite worked through that, and maybe Don's further than I remember. But obviously we would make that obvious if anything was going to be left. But as it stands now, it's more about the functioning and designation of historic sites through this committee process, which planning has never really been involved in.
So I'll just put it out there. If there's a historic site that needs to be designated, how would that function under the current ordinance, and how would it function by changing it to?
It'd be the my understanding it would be the same process. Mm-hmm. This historic preservation committee, by the rules that will be set up by the National Park Service and administered through the Certified Local Grant Program, would create an inventory of potential project or potential sites, which our previous committee had a pretty good inventory of those sites. As every year comes up and a new, you know, they're looking at a 50-year horizon. So things that were done in 1974 now start, or 1975 now become potentially historic sites. The committee will keep a running track of what those are in the community. And if there was to be a project on any of those sites, the committee would get involved in those.
And would the committee just make that designation and
it would come back
suddenly to, that's a historic site, or
no, it comes back to you for approval. They
so
would make
we
a recommendation.
Vote on it. Council votes on it. They recommend to us, council votes on it. Doesn't go to the Planning Commission.
And let me give you another example of something that we've removed from Title 17, and that's home occupations. As we looked at home occupations, it has more of a business licensing aspect to it than it has a zoning aspect to it. So we moved the bulk of those regulations out of Title 17 and 16 into Title 5, which is business licensing. There's still some use regulations in Title 17 like there would be for any business, but the actual function of business licensing of home occupations has been moved to Title 5, just because it makes a lot of sense to regulate it through there. Did the regulations change much? No. But when you put something in Title 17, it adds this layer of land use rights that run with the land that are different than regulating it through other titles of our code.
But designating it as a historic site is effectively a land use decision, is it not?
Not necessarily. Not if we, not, I mean, the National Register is its own thing. The State Register is its own thing. Unless we create some scheme, we don't actually have any real land use type regulations of historic structures in the city. I think there was also a time where, and you'll see this like in our old general plan, where there were these historic land use designations. We still have a quote-unquote historic land use designation in our current general plan, but there may have been a thought at some point to create a district to create more land use type regulations of historic structures, but that has never happened.
Well, I think the difference is that we're talking about just a one property, you know, like Aunt Mame's, it's on one piece of property, it's one building.
It's already been designated.
Yeah, it's already been designated. But in larger towns like downtown and at, went on my head, the ski resort.
Park City.
I mean, I've done appraisals there, and you have to be really careful because they have whole neighborhoods that are supposed to follow certain codes. And like downtown, people still have to have the original windows in their houses.
I think Salt Lake calls them historic preservation zones.
Yeah.
And they have zoning, like, regulations around
them. Actual
zone. They have their underlying zone with densities and stuff. But then on top of that, they have the historic elements you have to preserve, such as windows and things like that.
Yeah, they have
like
a whole list
so
of things.
So there's kind of two tiers of zoning regulation for them.
And, the and homeowners, if they don't want to follow that, or they have some reason they can't, they have to go through a whole appeal process, which probably is then when you get a planning commission involved. I think when you just have this one off thing, and we're providing the money for it, or we're helping with it, we have a lot more say and control.
And traditionally, I would say the city hasn't pushed property owners towards that historic preservation piece. And now I'm forgetting their names. The church on 13th West, at the property.
The Purple Church.
Yeah, they recently had the property appraised, and there was a question about whether it had ever been designated historic and had to do with our land use, and the appraiser was a bit confused, which caused, to your point, lots of concerns about these added things. But the Frottons never, and this is according to Anne, have never sought historic designation for their property.
Well, council people who have wanted to.
Sure, right. but we've left it to property owners, and there's other examples in the city of property owners that have gotten the historic designation, but that's all through the National Register, not through any sort of overlay of a city process.
Right, the city's informed of that process along the way and get our support, like when Kim Bergen's home was put on the register.
I don't have any other questions.
Okay. So do you have an answer what to do?
So if you our recommendation is to move it to Title II and put it in the duties of the Historic Preservation Committee and take it out of the land use section, and for all intents and purposes the process will remain the same as we've started drafting the ordinance. We've just taken word for word language with the state's blessing with the word district included. That would be the only substantive, if you consider that substantive, that'd be the only change.
I like consolidating it all into just one title. So
how about you, Patrick?
I have no issues with what's being recommended.
So yeah. I guess it's clear.
Okay. Then with that, there'll be an amended bylaws for the Historic Preservation Committee referencing the new chapter in Title II. So they'll come together.
Well, thank you.
Okay, so
he's not done that. So we'll have a vote on that somewhere along the way.
We'll start working, scheduling it with Stephen at the Planning Commission, because it will have to have their notification process.
And I'll just add, a lot of your questions are ones that we came across as we looked at. The initial question is, why is it in Title 17? So we went through all of that, and hopefully it'll be more clear when Don brings it forward why, you know, when you're looking at the actual language, what the real difference is. And I don't think there's a lot of difference. So
in that discussion, as we've gone through this discussion with CLG and being grant compliant or being in compliance for a grant application, earlier last fall, the city put together a planning grant with the county's TRCC or the TRAC grant. And we had worked with the architectural firm that had helped us with with the fire station. They had done some initial, way back in the day, they had done some initial site work at MAMES. They didn't do the actual work anyways. We got them involved and got a quote to do from them to do some of the architectural planning, not to kind of get us to a construction drawing state so that we would know how much money an interior restoration of Aunt Mame's may cost, all the way from the any structural issues on the inside to some of the historic restoration that would take, you know, more of the aesthetic, which also included a mechanical, you know, to bring it up to have a good HVAC system, and the electrical's pretty old and plumbing is old. So we were going to do a planning grant with TRCC. Long or the short of it, we were denied a grant. We had submitted for about a $90,000 grant, of which was going to be $10,000 for the CLG grant. We got denied, and which was a little bit eye-opening. Usually planning grants at the TRAC fund are pretty easy to get. We got our planning grant when we did our Arts Master Plan. And as you may or may not recall, Aunt Mames was included as a potential site for future art programming or whatever. Our understanding of why the city was denied the grant was because the intent of use for the facility was too broad. And in being broad, they had a lot of questions about what they really wanted to hear is that it was going to be a public facility, and anything that was broader than public felt, and maybe it felt private, they weren't willing to put the TRAC grant towards. So as we heard that discussion, as well as knew that we were going through the CLG discussion, also, if you remember, about a little over a year ago, the mayor met with some of the Newbold family and talked about Aunt Mames, and Denise Newbold and Russ Newbold have kind of re-energized some of the discussion of restoring Aunt Mames' interior as the next generation of family, because Bruce has passed away, Russ and Denise's dad, Dennis, passed away, and Richard is the only surviving brother there, and you probably know better than I, his health isn't all that great. But Denise is a South Jordan resident, and she'd like to see something happen there. And so she's actually in China now. She went on an exchange, and her husband passed away, and she's on an exchange there doing some work with Brigham Young University now, teaching English. But Russ and her had re-energized some efforts and seeing about getting some funding available for Aunt Mame's interior. Meaning the city, ever since I was part of the process, and when Mayor Money back in the day was the mayor, we've always said that public funding from the city was done with when we did the exterior restoration, that any interior restoration funding would need to come through grant funding or funding from the family. And that's why, for the most part, that's why nothing's happened on the inside. Nobody's really taken any bull by the horn since the exterior was done to do any type of interior. And this was kind of our first go at getting funding to do anything there. And so, like I said, we found out that in going and getting grants, to having a very specific understanding of what that use might be is going to be very critical if we're ever going to get to that. And so I don't know if that tonight is the night to help to, you know, get some direction on what that use might be, but either a resolution from the council or some direction from you to so that we know what type of grants to go to, that we can put as a resource in submitting for grants, or as the Newbold family, they are in the process of establishing a 501c3, so that they can apply for some grants as well, I think would be helpful. And so if we just kind of wanted to have that discussion with you tonight as well, if you felt comfortable putting some parameters together for that interior restoration and maybe helping give some guidance for our efforts at AmMames.
Does staff have any guidelines of what you see it could be? I mean, I've never restored a building, so.
We've had over the years when we've talked about it in strategic planning, I think that the public, and even from the very beginning in some of the initial and guiding documents, that when the dedication of the home and the property came to the city, was that it would be publicly available. So when we have had discussions about it being more of a private use, whether that was those have kind of been, let's not go there, let's not have it be the next insurance agency in a restored home. Let's
I was thinking it'd be more of a wedding bed venue.
When the track committee asked about a wedding venue, is it a city-owned wedding venue? Is it a leased wedding? Those are some of the questions that they had. You know, so yeah, we had Zions Bank years ago put together a study of what historic homes or like this have been used for around the country, and gave us some recommendations there. And it was, you know, as you might expect, it's everything. That's why when we did the Arts Master Plan, we wanted to make sure that if it was going to be an arts type of facility that was 501, that was nonprofit related, that, you know, this, the city's ownership and maybe a nonprofit owns, you know, operates it. And it became a resident art place, or there's a lot of examples of that.
With the Newbold family wanting to start a 501(c)(3), to help with the restoration, do they have something in mind that they're wanting to see the city restore it to? Or are they just really trying to make sure it gets fully preserved?
When they don't have anything specific, but they were broad, they thought broad as well. They did think of it more, they probably have more of a private use type thought, so that there is a revenue generator on the back side of it to not only help restore it potentially, but also to help fund the ongoing maintenance and operation of whatever that was going to be. They want to preserve that public accessibility, but you know, throw out the bed and breakfast idea has been brought up, that opens a whole other can of worms in light of our discussions with Airbnbs and stuff around the community. But
what's the square footage of the facility, and is it, it's really just one level, isn't it? And then there's a basement?
It's two levels.
Oh, it is two.
There's a main level and then an upstairs, and half the upstairs was lived in, and then the north side, it's just an open attic that would have to, it would have to finish it. There's just stairs. So accessibility has always been an issue. That's why we put the staircase around the north side, so that there was an ADA accessibility into the home.
And what are our ADA requirements to make this a public building and having a second story on it? Do we have to
have
an elevator or something to it? Or
you don't have to, but ties... The building official becomes the ultimate say in there, and
okay. That
was going to be part of our architectural design discussion when we when we got everybody
on involved. A lot of them, they just don't let anybody go beyond the main floor.
By storage.
Right.
They just close it off and only employees, authorized personnel.
Well, I was even wondering under the employee only.
You make
aspect.
A you make accommodation on
under
the
that
floor.
If we had an employee that worked with that but couldn't do stairs or something like that, their accommodation would be somebody else to do it.
If we're just talking one floor, that house is not that big. I mean, there's not only so much you can do
exactly.
in that house on just that main floor.
Right.
You know,
you have three rooms on the north side and the main rooms in the kitchen.
Yeah.
The two main rooms in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Is the historical committee talked about it at all? That's right. Or?
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, I mean, I think it's fair to say that they're. Especially, you know, the Newbolds were really hoping that the city could go in there. And I think somewhere along the way, there are certain people that felt like the city's obligation to go in there and finish it. You know, that one's a tough one. I mean, the family, I mean, Aunt Mame didn't have any kids, and so that land got left to the Newbolds. And well, then, in a perfect world, I wish that the city council at that point in time said, okay, we'll take that land, we'll take the house, but it needs to be, you need to get it fully preserved. And once in a fully preserved state, we'll take it over and maintain it from that point in time over. I think that was a mistake, honestly, at that point in time. This is for us to spend $1.5 million, and then we haven't even touched the interior, and we have all this other stuff that needs to get done to it. And just the layout of it for public use, and you know, you're going up and down those stairs is difficult. And there's just, I mean, probably if you looked at probably the fire code, I mean, the number of people that actually could probably be in there all at one point in time. I don't think you could ever have a wedding inside that house. You know, it'd have to be extremely small.
Been inside.
Yeah.
I was just thinking what would attract, what people would be attracted to use it.
And
yeah.
Sorry. Under the restoration idea. What are we fully talking about restoring? Are we trying to recreate it to where it's like it was in whenever the house was built? Is it we're just going to go in and preserve molding around windows and doors, but we can just leave it blank? We don't have to put another kitchen in? Like
again, that was one of those. That was part of our scope of work when we were going to have the architects and get an estimate for that so that we understood what restored to historic terms to just the basic, you know, here you could have some offices or some public space. But I agree with what Patrick was saying. In the state of Utah, the way they fund historic preservation is through historic tax credits, and the builders and developers get the tax benefit for that. For instance, when I was in Brigham City and city manager up there, we had a historic home on Main Street, and that's the model that we took. The family restored the home and then donated it to the city, and then the city rents it out and we maintain it, but the rental is what pays for the care and upkeep for it on an annual basis. But the initial capital outlay was by the family.
Look and learn.
There's a lot more money that needs to get spent on it. That's the hard part.
Or you just leave it locked up.
Or we just leave it locked up.
And you appreciate the outside.
Yeah, you appreciate the outside. Yeah.
But you're still going to have to do some maintenance to. I mean.
We do.
It's got wood shingles on it.
We do main. Yeah, we do minimum maintenance.
What would happen if we sold it?
I mean,
not an option.
So there are some terms.
The
conservation easement has some terms to that, and it also has a reversionary to the family, and but they can't sell it either.
Oh, they can't sell it either.
Mm-hmm. Not for profit.
Conservation.
Didn't know that.
Maybe we give it back to them.
So there isn't, other than the Newbolds, you that live down the area, Patrick, you may know better. There isn't a large clamor to restore the interior. it's probably the most, maybe not, it's a highly visited and photographed property in the city, and next to the lake, maybe more family photos get taken down there. But I don't, other than the new builds, I don't have a lot of people clamoring to get on the inside and to use the facility. But
over the years, I mean, I've had a good amount of people ask me if the city's ever going to do anything.
Right.
And they say the problem is just trying to determine what the use would be.
I mean, it's not in your district.
No, it's
not in the historical community.
No.
It's just out of the blue. People are asking. Mm-hmm. I can't.
Probably because they went and took family photos still.
I can't recall ever having it. A constituent talked to me about it.
I bet there's...
There's a park, you know, the park does get reserved on occasion, and there have been, the Newbolts have had weddings on, the Newbolt family has had weddings down there, and the city's had events down there.
I remember being there for an event on one occasion. I don't even know what it was, but I remember being there.
It's been a while since there's been a community event there, but...
But my guess is there's probably a large part of the city that doesn't even know it exists.
I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Mm-hmm.
I mean, unless you go to that park, you would never know.
Right. It sits down off the...
has no visibility.
Off the road, it has limited visibility. I mean, it's a great, quiet, secluded location and peaceful in that. Most people get... the Bergen home and Aunt Mame's home confused with the historic home.
Is the Bergen home the red one across from the temple?
Across from the temple.
But I'm sure if we started to do something, all those neighbors would probably have an opinion.
Or be well known.
Your phone would light up, Patrick.
Okay.
As long as it's something that people like, it'll be fine.
Just not in Tom's office.
Tim,
better
Nikolai-
put a splash pad in there.
Tim Nicolaisen keeps really good watch on it. He's lives next door to it and very active. And he asks me occasionally. So,
I mean, the million-dollar question is there going to be enough money in grants down the road? Over time to finish that inside out. And I mean, how many years are we talking about if we continue to get grants?
We're not going to do it with CLG grants.
Yeah.
You're going to need to get an Eccles or a Larry H. Miller or a. You're going to need to get, and you could get, as I've talked with the Newbold Russ is an architecture, a historic restoration. Professional out of he's in New York and he does a lot of historic restoration projects, obviously back there in Massachusetts, Connecticut, and that. And
Russ Newbold.
And Russ did all of the detail. The city hired Russ when we restored Aunt Mame's. He did all of that for a very discounted cost, and he did a lot of the design work for the homes, for the restoration, for the homes in the subdivision as well. What our thought was is we were going to do the planning aspect, break the home up into reasonable phases, and then start to go out and show and try to sell this to the Eccles and the Miller Foundations and see what response that we got from.
I guess the question that's rattling around in my
Swords and Foundations, the other one.
How can you do planning for restoration if we don't have a purpose in mind? You know,
it's always been.
How do you approach the foundations? Going off of your thought, Don, how can we approach the foundations if we don't have that purpose?
Well, there's not going to be any emotional response, you know.
Yeah.
Right. We're going to have to figure out a purpose before we can do any of that, I think. And I don't know, maybe our historical committee needs to think of a purpose. or maybe we need to think of it, or maybe we really do need to get rid of it somehow.
Well, it's just too bad that someone from the family doesn't have the time or the foresight to lead the charge. That's probably what you really need, is someone to really...
And I think when Denise gets back from China, that's, she's the most logical one from the family to do that. Richard was never fully... Richard was interested, but Bruce was the one that was engaged at the time of the initial...
Is it possible that, let's say someone in the family, you could say, we'll give it back to you, and they could, on their own, finish it off and live it, live inside it? I mean, that's, there is a residence?
Oh. I think all options are out there. I hadn't talked about...
Just say, hey, I mean, here you go. You know, I mean, that's... First got $1.5 million on it, and you just take it from here, and we'll turn it back to you, and you go finish off the inside of it, and the home stays, and...
Outside of some compelling public purpose, I would lean that direction, I have to say.
Yeah.
I mean, we've talked about city uses, whether that's parks office or recreation office. We explored the Gale Center potential use, and we're at where we're at because none of those...
So small.
None of them fit?
None of them fit. Or sustainable.
I think we should explore getting them back to the family.
And I've had that discussion. I had that discussion with Bruce, and I've had that discussion with Denise. And
I think they're thinking of it as a public use, though. You just say, hey, we'll give it back to you, and you can use it as a private home. I'm just throwing out
with
an
visitors
idea.
Taking pictures.
Our conservation easement would need to be adjusted because it talks about public accessibility and
that's what the 1.5 million was for too. And so there would have to be some idea of composition if you're giving it back to them for a private exclusive use.
Or maybe the part of the lot gets carved out where, hey, this part is for public use and just have a little smaller spot for the house. I don't know.
And there's a way we can do that. It's not all dollar for dollar. It's compensation, it's consideration. And so there's ways to figure that out.
We haven't talked about the private family, that personal use. That would be new.
And they can go finish it off inside how they want.
Do what they want. They finish it off for the city attorney's office.
On that idea.
I think we have plenty of office space. Just trying to push in.
He's always in his car anyway, isn't he?
It's not big enough for a fire station.
No.
I mean, if we could find a way where the people living there could still somehow use the property around there, and someone could actually go put that home to use instead of just sitting empty.
I think that's a win. I mean, right now no one's going inside of it anyway, you know. But as long as it's, I think the people around that area, if you all of a sudden, you know, they couldn't access it, I think they'd have issues with that. But use the exterior part of it, of that property. I don't know.
Still a big loss for the city, though.
Well,
it's a sunk cost right
it's
now.
It's a sunk cost.
Right, Don?
It's not part of the decision going forward. Seriously.
Yeah.
If you were in a boardroom, they would not discuss sunk cost. They would discuss what's best going forward.
But I think residents will not look at it that way.
How much money if we were truly going to finish it off on the inside, and or through whatever? How much is it to get up to the standards that we would be doing it at? How much are we talking?
Probably more than it would be to model it, tear it down, and rebuild it from the ground.
Yeah, I think you're $1.5 million at a minimum.
More? On top of what we already spent? So we've already $1.5 million and another $1.5 million.
By the time you do...
So you can build for $3 million.
You could build an exact replica for less.
Yeah.
We've had...
With all the modern amenities of heating, cooling, wiring, plumbing.
I think we give the family a very nice gift and say, you know what, here you go, but we're going to have to work it out on the exterior side where the public can still have access to some of these amenities, since you know, but and then they can figure out within the family how they want to finish it off, and I don't know.
They probably don't have the resources either.
That's what I was going to say. I doubt they're in a position that they can do it.
That's
why they wanted the partnership with the city in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but let's just think about it. Let's say you're a grandchild. It's like, okay, now you don't have to worry about how we would do it. And you already have a shell there. I mean, and you just go and you can just go in there and do traditional whatever you want inside of it, you know.
Make it modern
inside. That is definitely doable.
A lot of people who do buy the old houses just for the shells.
So someone has the land and the shell already there, and it's already, you know, everything's all hooked up to the utilities, and you just have to go do the interior work on it.
The interior designer of the architecture firm did just that.
Mm-hmm.
Saw the inside, she's like, this is my home.
Yeah.
If the council's direction would we go that way, we'd have to sit down and figure out how we make legally we can take a city asset and dispose of it in a way that works legally. And I'm sure there's a way. I don't know that we've thought about it at all.
Would they ever be able to sell it based on, you know, could someone get it and do that and then sell it, or would they have to hold on to it?
I haven't seen the conservation easement for a long time.
Easement says that they can't sell it for profit.
Yeah, and so we'd have to look at that. What's the value of it? We've put $1 million into it, but what is the actual present day value?
Can we change that conservation easement?
What can we do? We hold it. So without sitting down and really digging into it, I don't have answers on that.
I still just struggle with it. It's one of the last historic things we have left in this city. Yeah, I understand the whole sunken cost concept, but that's still, tearing down, I guess we wouldn't be tearing it down, but
Should be going back to the family.
Getting rid of it as a city asset is a struggle for me.
What do you propose?
I don't know. I haven't really pondered much about hat names over the years.
Well, and that's part of the reason to come to you.
Really had an in-depth discussion as a council since I've been on it about what we want to do with it. There's been little side conversations, but we've never explored it in the last 7 years.
Well, I think it's something that we should make a snap decision over. And I also think we should have the full council have everybody. Well, I know that will happen anyway, but
yeah.
This is kind of preliminary.
I think people ought to... Maybe we ought to do a field trip there sometime, open up the doors and peek in there. I think you guys will be surprised that there's not a lot of space.
Oh, I've been there many times.
And so I'm just trying to think.
I've been in locked both houses.
Yeah.
I know what to expect.
Yeah. I just try to think. I was like, okay, what could we...
I know how scary they can be.
What could we do inside? Yeah.
And that's good. And...
And even if we fix it up, what would we do with it? You know what?
That's for 18 years, that's been the dilemma.
That's why, I mean, if that dilemma can't be solved in the last 18 years, I don't know that we'll solve it in the next 18 months, you know? So that's why I lean towards moving in a different direction.
We could put something in there that the family has to keep it as a family owned. They can't sell it, and so they could rent it to their adult grandchildren. Whatever that looks like, you know.
Yeah, but then how long until it just ends up like a lot of the old homes throughout the state, where the family eventually just no one wants it, no one can take care of it, and it's just left to fall apart.
Yeah, certainly we don't want that.
Yeah, how do you then put that in that then puts a burden on the family going forward that future generations have to somehow continue to maintain it?
I think if we change that, if we were going to give it back to the family, I think we'd just have to give them all the rights of ownership pretty much, you know.
Is
Such a happy topic, Don. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
Any more rays of sunshine to share with us?
No. Say, I think you continue to ponder on it. And
but are people kind of thinking the best use for it is actually a house, a home to live in for someone? Is that kind of,
is that what you're so far?
I guess it
seems, like that.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think
it's not
I
big enough for an alternative use.
Yeah, it's not a reception type facility.
I mean, if you try and put something commercial down there, then that neighborhood will explode, you know?
Well, it doesn't fit well.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've thought of a myriad of nonprofit type of uses, but it starts to go into that commercial side of
because you
things.
Need you want to have the revenue to support
like
it
if
over
it
time.
Was an artist maker place, you know, that they had their studios in there as well as a, you know, but it goes to, it lends itself to a smaller type of use.
Art studio is not a terrible idea. I mean, it's the ones we talked about. It's not terrible. I mean, for someone to rent and
right.
Do their artwork in there, but
I know in some of my discussions with Salt Lake City's Arts Council, they have a lot of artist makers places that are turning over, and they're having fewer and fewer of them downtown. And so like your Dreamscapes that used to be over in Southtown Mall, they're all being displaced and moved into other areas. But so, and so they're looking for somebody that has a place like this that they could do. They could go to, but then it becomes, you know, how is the rent and how is the space maintained and how much space is available. But then trying to hook up with the right people that are available, I don't know who would be that person. That's one reason why we put that as a potential option in the Arts Master Plan.
Which hasn't been explored at all.
We could have review that with the Arts Committee.
Yeah.
Let's just say, hey, is there, maybe we don't go all the way out and try to get it completely historical inside. We just, you know, do more of a
right
a normal type finish inside, you know, and if there's a demand to do for someone to rent it out for arts, maybe that's something that could be explored.
Yeah.
That could always be restored at a later date if that ever became important.
Yeah.
Or you just do just the minor. I mean, you go in, you put in the basic, you know, utilities, plumbing, the floors, but for the restoration aspect, you leave the wood around the windows, all that type of original trim.
Just a rough.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that what artists like?
Some like blank canvases.
I'm sure there's some codes of what it would need to be brought up to.
They're usually pretty good at working around what they have that's available.
Yeah.
The ultimate DIY.
I mean, I think those are two.
Yeah, I think that's something that could be explored from a probably Arts Council art, probably more the art staff. I mean, the Arts Council could throw out a lot of different ideas. For use.
Well, we can get in touch with the arts community and see if what's of demand in this area.
I think that's a reasonable direction, at least before we turn it back over, just see if it's doable and if there's need for it and demand for it and how much it costs for us to pull it off relatively inexpensively. I don't know. Don, what do you think?
I'm willing to explore all the ideas. I don't think we're up against any deadline here. So
no,
we've had 18 years.
We're 15. Yeah.
We can kick that game.
2010 is when we finished the outside. So we have 15 years. Another day or two isn't gonna.
Are we ready to move on?
Don's ready for us to move
on. Get me out of my chair.
I'm gonna get fired pretty soon. So now flag lots looks like a really interesting...
more rays of sunshine.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Don.
You make Steven come up there and
yeah,
sit
there. Yeah, I think so.
His name's not Donnie. Yeah,
I'll have Joe come sit in that chair. Joe's name should have been the presenter tonight. I'll just give you a little bit of background, a little reminder. We went from having no flag lots as part of our ordinance to allowing flag lots on lots that are 2 times the average size in the subdivision, to then creating, in addition to that, a flag lot floating zone, which means somebody has to come to you in a rezone with a development agreement if they don't have that super large lot in a subdivision. They still have criteria to meet, but the thinking at the time was that that would give the council the ability to look at individual circumstances and make a decision of whether a flag lot makes sense. As we struggled through the very first application that came before you, because the ordinance had been in place for several years before we received anything formally before you, as we struggled through that, it became clear that we probably just needed to take a step back, have a conversation, revisit some of those regulations. We have a couple applications. Well, we have one application waiting in the wing. We have several potential applicants who are sort of waiting for this. So you passed a pending ordinance that kind of puts a pause on new applications, or at least puts a pause on them vesting in the process. And this is now staff's attempt to come back to create a discussion to understand what your concerns were. Not necessarily with that first application. They're scheduled to come back to you next council meeting to understand what their next steps are, but to take a step back generally to understand how comfortable you are with flag lots. Joel will run through some options and provide a little more background.
Great, thank you. So when we got into things here, we were looking at, we took a step back, not just from South Jordan, but kind of took a look at all the communities around us, looked at a number of different comparable communities to see what, All right, so we looked at a number of different communities around the valley here. We are the only ones that have an administrative or a legislative process to allow for flag lots in addition to the administrative proposal. So in most communities, you either meet those standards or you don't. Sandy's.
So all those have allow for flag lots. So.
They do. Yes. Sandy has one kind of strange thing with the special exception, which I know Ryan would advise us is not an option.
It's an option. It's just not a very easy one to.
Yeah.
To consistently enforce, it's unless you treat it like a conditional use permit or something that has rules and stuff around it, special exceptions get messy.
Yeah, so us having the administrative option is a little bit unique, but it is
the legislative option.
The legislative option, the administrative option is pretty standard for all of those flag lots. So we do have that still. So if you're able to meet that large lot size that Stephen mentioned, it's twice the size of the average platted lot in that subdivision, you're able to still go that administrative route. Otherwise, you would need to go to that legislative process. And some of the things we looked at here, you're required a development agreement in that legislative process. You're also, we do enhanced noticing, so it's not just people in 300 feet radius. It's everybody in the subdivision plus those in the 300 foot radius that get noticed. We do allow for a preliminary subdivision that can run concurrently, but it can't get approved until both the zoning and the development agreement have been passed.
What does that mean?
So it means they can have a subdivision application waiting that can be approved, but it can't be approved until the legislative overlay zone gets approved.
So usually You would come and get your zoning, and then you would apply for a subdivision. We would not accept your application for subdivision until you get the zoning. But this, the PD floating zone, is another ordinance that allows, and it's sort of at their risk, right? And the one that came before you a couple months ago, they tried it. Planning Commission was uncomfortable saying, because what the motion would be at Planning Commission is, we approve the subdivision subject to the City Council approving the development agreement and the zoning. And then it wouldn't have to go back to Planning Commission. It would just at that point be in effect. They could then record their subdivision or apply for a final plat. The Planning Commission tabled that decision because they didn't feel comfortable approving it until after finding out whether the zone would be approved or not. So it doesn't work very well. At least not in that last application.
Right. And well, you mentioned that it does involve kind of the applicant's risk if they want to go to the trouble of putting together the plat and everything before their zone's been approved. One of the things we do require as part of their application for the zone would be getting elevations and building footprint and those kinds of things as well. So it is a considerable amount of risk, I guess, for an applicant to go this route. You know, we looked at kind of three different baskets of tools that people have put in some of these codes to regulate flag lots. We have three main categories. One would be the eligibility criteria, who can or can't have a flag lot. The second one is the design standards, so looking at, you know, how long the setbacks are, how tall the building is, all those types of things. And then in addition to that, there's administrative features which we can employ to help make things easier to understand for the public and staff and the approval bodies, you know, providing clarity and making sure that that's a really clear code. So diving into our first basket, so for the administrative process, we have three different criteria. You've got to have twice the average lot size in the subdivision. You've got to meet all of your requirements of the underlying zone, including density. So that density is calculated from the original platted subdivision. So not everybody in a subdivision, even though all the lots might meet that size, might not necessarily, or, you know, be able to qualify for that based off the density requirements. There's also a requirement that there's basically no other feasible way for them to connect to a future street. If we look at the legislative process, you know, it does not have those requirements, but it does require a minimum of 125 feet street frontage. And as Stephen mentioned, those unique circumstances is determined by City Council, so that's directly from the code.
It would have the second two administrative processes where you're having to meet the density requirements, for example. It wouldn't have that first one.
Right, sorry.
Yeah, no, you're good.
So when we look at kind of how some of this has been regulated in other communities, you know, sometimes they'll only allow flag lots on, you know, when you can't use a private right-of-way. You know, our private right-of-way standards are a lot like our public right-of-way standards. So maybe if we looked at, you know, evaluating when a private right-of-way might not necessarily need to be a full, you know, 28 feet wide, that could be a solution onto, you know, when this could be allowed, and maybe a private right-of-way is a better option for some people versus a flag lot. We could look at it as, you know, looking at a maximum number of lots within a subdivision. So we say, okay, you know, you can only have two lots per subdivision that are eligible for a flag lot or something like that. Sometimes people will also have a cap where you're like, okay, we're only going to allow flag lots within a subdivision that is 20 lots or fewer. So if you're in a subdivision of 21 lots or more, you're not eligible. There are communities out there that do have those kinds of caps on what subdivisions are eligible. We do use this part here where we have a maximum of two lots being created from the original parcel. So you can't subdivide one lot into three. You can subdivide two lots into four, but that's the max. We also have other things that you can, you know, just not inhibit it, the development of neighboring parcels. So giving you kind of a, making sure that, that flag lot's not cutting off other future developments. Looking at access restrictions. So, you know, do you allow these on an arterial or a collector street, or are they allowed on cul-de-sacs? Different communities have different stances on all of those factors. And, you know, some limit it by what zones are eligible. So you might say, you know, only an ag zoning is eligible for a flag lot, those kinds of things. So it's a, there's a lot of different options out there. I guess we can hop, before I hop into sort of the design standards, are there any questions on any of these potential features that people have used or have?
So did you cull these from that list of cities that are neighbors?
Yeah.
These.
Yeah, they're primarily found in most of those in most of those cities there. Yeah.
And did you find cities that don't allow flag lots at all?
I did not. Not in the Salt Lake area.
Are anyone deed restricting these things so they, you know, can't be turned into rentals?
No, we have not found anybody who has any kinds of restrictions on the use when it comes to rental. I mean, the only restriction on use is generally that it's a single family dwelling. When it comes to accessory dwelling units and those sorts of things, that's not something that's been included in other regulations that I've read through here. But I guess that...
Is that something that we could visit and talk about? I mean, I'm not saying right this moment, but that, is that something that could be on the table? You know, we're... You know, I mean, the only reason I bring that up, and we can do it at the right time, just, you know, there's a need for more housing, you know, for sale housing. I also get concerns with subdividing these lots where you could have, you know, additional, you know, lot and then accessory dwelling, and you have all these rentals in there. I also see that. So is there anything we can do with, you know, with deed restrictions to
differently? I think that now that there's that tool of doing the accessory lot, why do we need to have flag lots? I mean, they're essentially the same thing, but I think as an accessory unit, there's more control by the homeowner. I mean, once you sell that property off, I just see it, they're basically the same thing.
Except one on a flag lot, you can sell the flag lot, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, or accessory dwelling unit, you can't sell your accessory dwelling unit.
Yeah, and it can't be metered separately.
There's legislation we're talking about.
Not legislation. There's talk of legislation.
There's a city that's allowing it.
But there is a city that has come up with a scheme. I believe it's Harmington.
Up in Davis County.
Yes. I believe it's Harmington, but don't quote me on that. I have to like, but they've come up with a scheme that you could create an ADU and then sell it and actually get ownership, and I don't know.
So that's a flag lot. Why don't they just have a flag lot?
Essentially, but I don't know how that works. From how exactly that works.
And certainly, the difference between putting a detached ADU versus a flag lot is the width of the driveway, fire access, things like that. Where when it's a separate lot, all of those things come into play. When it's a detached ADU, we don't have those same requirements because the idea would be that the primary owner is still in charge of the property.
I guess that kind of tees us up for some of these design standards. We kind of touched on these earlier. You know, there are some current building code requirements as well. So like if you have a you're over a certain length, the fire department will require a hammerhead turnaround for them, in addition to our lot parcel maximum. When we looked at kind of surrounding communities and what they were doing, there are some that regulate the minimum width of that access strip. So it's got to be so wide all the way down, so it's an accessible space. There's also maximum lengths on that access strip sometimes, but it could also extend to driveway paving materials, grade maximums, you know, how looking at safety aspects as to what's going to make sure that that's an accessible property, including, you know, address markers from the street and things. I know a lot of public safety departments struggle with flag lots just from an addressing perspective, so having a requirement that those addresses are posted at the street so people can find them is important. Looking at minimum driveway separations too, so, you know, maybe you can't have that flag lot driveway within a certain amount of distance from a neighboring home. Looking at minimum lot sizes that, you know, maybe we look at the minimum lot size being based off of the base zoning rather than the average subdivision. You know, most, I think that there's some challenges with using the average sub, the average subdivision size. It takes a lot of research to kind of pull that plat, calculate the average lot size in that plat. And I don't think most homeowners are able to easily do that and tend to rely on the planning department to come help them figure out if they're eligible for that. So we have to kind of walk them through that and do a bit of research to find that plat, do the calculations, and also check to see if that density would allow for a flag lot in that particular subdivision. So some cities have just switched to using, you know, maybe you have to be, I know Mill Creek is 150% of the underlying zoning district, for instance. So that's their minimum lot size for a flag lot. And they actually exclude the flag lot access strip from that calculation as well. So, you know, there's a number of ways you could look at making that a larger lot or being a little bit more flexible with that component. Some cities do also require additional setbacks, including accessory building setbacks. Those can include those. Some even limit the number of stories that that's flag lot could be. You know, they'll say it's a one-story maximum on that flag lot home. If there's overlooking concerns, you know, that could be a way to address them. Some will say you have to have additional, you know, you have a reduced max coverage, so you can't have as many structures on that lot as, you know, somebody else with the same zoning. And then the guest house prohibition, that would be unique. That's not something that I've seen in another code, but it, you know, it's a possibility. Internal ADUs are a lot trickier to regulate when it comes to an ADU or a flag lot, just because of the state legislation. But we have more control over those guest houses. The other things that sometimes I've seen in these are fencing requirements or screening requirements for those driveways, or even fire hydrant requirements and things. It's a lot that can be looked at and played with to say, you know, in what circumstances are we comfortable? What do these things look like to make sense for a flag lot, and what doesn't?
So, you know, Joe's thrown a lot of options at you, which is a good thing to see the many things that we could include in an ordinance, right? Ultimately, our goal is to understand what is important to you, and we can take some of these options to bring back an ordinance for you to review. So the guest house one is an obvious one that came up during the last application, and it feels a little unresolved to me. And so it would be good to get, and you had mentioned, Councilman Harris, something else that you wondered if we should get into right now or not. We're happy to get into some of the concerns that you may or may not have about, oh, it's the rentals, right? Deed restricting rentals, things like that. We want to understand what are the concerns, and then we can take some of these options and see if they can address those concerns. Because each of these things address some concern that a community had about the effects of flag lots.
Exactly. Are there anything else that kind of resonates or sticks out as something that would be, you think would be applicable here?
We just want to open up for discussion.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, I think that if we're going to do these,
because there's a need for more for sale housing. I think that makes sense. That's the reason I kind of like the, you know, deed restricting these to, you know, for sale. I do have a little bit of trouble where people are just trying to see how many rentals they can get, and so I can get this much rental income off this property. It changes that, can change that neighborhood pretty quickly. But with deed restrictions on for sale housing, I understand, you know, there's a need, you know, and if some of these lots are pretty good size and they have the ability to help with that problem, you know, that we have. But I think it would be really hard for me to get okay with it with just where it just became somehow we left it open-ended and they people just have all these rentals. That'd be tough for me to get okay with all flag lots.
I like the guest house prohibition as well, personally, because, you know, I mean, we're already going into a subdivision and dramatically increasing the density, potentially. And then adding a guest house on top of that, you know, on the two lots that are created out of one.
And that was essentially part of the application that was before you.
Right.
It was in
the development agreement.
And there's a question about an external ADU's guest house and an internal, whether those are
appropriate. Right.
And it's really hard to deed restrict a guest house because trying to figure out who's going to be in that guest house is pretty tough.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Jason, that's helpful.
Just looking at these considerations up there, I do think we should set some type of minimum width frontage requirement for the access strip. And
standard. So that's the lot, is that what you're thinking, Jason, when you say that? The lot.
Well, minimum width. Well, I guess there's a couple things I'm thinking there. The actual lot, and then isn't also saying how wide the access strip needs to be?
The flag portion.
The flag portion, yeah.
Currently, we have a requirement that it's a minimum of 125 feet of street frontage to be eligible for that flag lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think we have anything in our standards that generally speak to the minimum width of the access strip.
And that's what you're saying.
The driveway. Right?
Yeah, we're trying to hold 20 feet on that for the most part, because that's the fire
requirement.
Right.
That's why I figured you'd have something pretty standard. But, I mean, it seems like that should just be in there as part of the code of, hey, if you came and get a fire truck down that lane, then we're not interested in having anything back there.
Then you're toast.
Yeah.
I
think, yeah, definitely need to put in driveway paving standards, probably just whatever would be required for a normal driveway. I don't know. Yeah.
And I like the address marker.
Should have the address marker. And I think there should be a minimum separation from the driveway, that new driveway being created in the neighboring home. I mean, you think about just kind of, you know, depending on what the setbacks are. I mean, a lot of those areas are probably pretty big, but do you suddenly just want, you know, a driveway next to maybe
right adjacent to your
might be your master bedroom or something, or, you know, just may not be, yeah. Just think having that separation would be a good thing to just have in the code.
Something that go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think we do need to address the heights, number of stories, restrictions. That always comes up when someone's building something in their backyard, whether it's the massive shed or, people are always concerned about people being able to look over. And I agree with what you guys have said about guest houses. And fire hydrants, I'd leave up to probably just the fire department. I think that might have to be a case-by-case evaluation. What were you going to say, Stu?
I was just going to say, Councilwoman Zander, the last discussion seemed to be more comfortable where the access driveway was shared between two lots rather than having one lot that adds a driveway. Is that something that's of concern to you?
So the two properties share a driveway?
So in her mind, at least, and she will correct me if I'm wrong. But
the original home and the new home would share the driveway.
No, so you would have two new flag lots. So in the situation where you had two adjacent existing lots that were large enough to have a flag lot, our ordinance says you have to share that driveway. So the example there on the right, thank you, Joe, that she is okay with, or more okay with that happening in a neighborhood than having more lots that just have the one driveway access.
But the problem is going to be, what if they don't do the two properties at the same time?
Yeah, well, right.
And then
right.
The second property comes in, but they don't have the room on that side because their garage is on the other side of the home.
Right.
And having lived in a house that had a shared driveway, it can be fun deciding who's going to be shuffling and removing that snow from the driveway.
I mean,
I like that idea when it's practical, if someone is trying to develop two lots at the same time.
And certainly if the two lots came in at the same time, we would require them to have a shared driveway.
Yes. I could be on board with that.
Could we have a two-lot minimum?
Well, so that really is the question, right? So if that were a real concern, then you would have to have a two-lot minimum.
But that's not always going to be the case at all.
And usually it won't be.
No. But, yeah, when someone is looking to put in a mini subdivision, then they should be required to do that shared, I think.
Well, I look at this problem different. I don't like flag lots.
I don't like them either.
And I know that I'm old and I have different experiences than the rest of you. So this happened when I was on Planning Commission. This subdivision in, what's it called again?
Let's see, Lucas Lane.
Lucas Lane. It's Lucas Dell.
Okay.
This was originally was all large lots. Don't want to unshare you. And so, and it happened quickly, probably over 2 or 3 years' time. You can see the ones with the arrows are the original lots that are left. To me, this is much better. We get a higher tax base out of it. You get new streets, it's a new development. You avoid a lot of problems. I just think it's better. From my experience,
what happened then? Talk us through what the process was that you're describing here.
Oh, what the process was is a developer came in. He bought a certain amount of lots. I think it was like more in the center.
Bought land.
He bought the lots, had houses on them.
Oh, okay.
Just what we're talking about now, except the road that he did is he bought them out, he packaged them up, brought them in, and so on planning we thought, oh, we'll just be a little additional subdivision, but within 2 or 3 years. Almost all of this just boomed. And then actually we felt guilty that we ruined this neighborhood because, I mean, it's nice homes, but I believe that we should have all kinds of housing here. And people who have larger lots, there's gonna be a demand for horse property or having a larger lot. And I think it's really unfair to sort of change the rules on those people. You know, and if the desire comes strong enough for that property, it will all be changed. And that way, those people will make a maximum amount of money selling their property, much more than they will selling off a part of it. Flag lots do not sell as much. You can have the same type of home, same amount of land, and they will be discounted over a home with regular frontage on a road. They take longer to sell. They can even be nicer, and they'll take longer to sell, from my experience.
I think that's
part of it just that people don't feel like they'll be part of a community. Your back hidden, you don't have street front, you're not part of the neighborhood.
There's no street appeal.
Yeah. It's one of the number one things in real estate is having street appeal. So.
And so, I mean, I know that we're beaten over the head about having more and more housing, but I also think that we're not having the hindsight of looking and saying we need all types of housing. And they can do their accessory unit, you know, and I hear the talk that, oh, well, you know, they're older, they don't have the money, and so they can keep their home, they can sell off part of it. Well, they have an AED, they can do, you know, rent somebody in their house. Like, there's other options.
So, Mayor Pro Tem, would your desire be more to go get do away with the floating flag zone and just go back to having a restrictive standard administrative approach?
I don't know
if we go completely, or would you rather just get away from flag lots 100%?
Yeah, that would be what I would support. Or if we have to have them, just have them be so hard that you can't get one.
No, I'm not a huge fan of flag lots either, and I would imagine to be more restrictive.
I would say if you're going to do a constructive prohibition, just say no.
Well, I think
we would much rather say no in the ordinance than create the question.
Yes. Our good friend Nancy Reagan said, just say no.
What's the read on what's going to happen with the legislature over time? Are cities going to be expected to do flag lots?
I've heard nothing pushing flag lots.
It's more on the ADU side that you're hearing stuff on?
Lots on ADUs, and all the stuff on the ADUs will be rental stuff. I haven't even heard of anything pushing, regardless of the one city that's figuring out some way. They say they're selling them, but that essentially creates a flag lot of some sort. I don't know exactly what the deal is there, but I've heard a lot on rentals. The anecdotal evidence, well, according to Speaker and some others that are involved in the space, the evidence on rentals is that the push recently, and I'm sure ADUs are part of this, to create more density in rentals has softened the rental market, meaning the prices for rentals are not going up as fast or are holding. I don't think they're coming down though. But they're not doing what they were doing because of the flood of rentals on the market. Flag lot is one portion of that. How much of it is, I don't know. Anecdotally, it seems like the houses, or I said flag lots, sorry, ADUs. It seems like the houses with ADUs has driven the housing price up. From the standpoint of ADUs, you'll see areas of our city that aren't allowed to have ADUs in the sense that everybody thinks of them, like Daybreak, advertising, you can do an ADU in Terminal there. When you can't, because from the sales side, from every side, they're pushing that as a way to pay for the house, way to market the house, A to Z. So I don't think we're going to see anything doing anything, pushing us at all with flag lots. Haven't heard of anything, hasn't been pushed. I think in the case we had here where we have an administrative process that gives greater access that was designed for one situation, we had somebody who understood that and decided to use that. And I'm not saying in any way, but to create an ability to build it, and ultimately the council has to decide whether you want to rezone it to that or not. It's like any zone.
Well, we still have the ability if they want to, you know, divide their property if they have, like, they're on a corner, don't we? Where they can.
It depends on the size of the lot. They still have to have without the legislative process we have. My recollection is they still have to have type 2 times the property even on a corner.
So no, on a corner.
Oh, because it's not
a
flag.
Yeah, it's not a flag. Chattel Estates which is, I'm gonna botch the part of the city that it's in. It's in your district. That was one of those subdivisions that we saw this increased pressure, and a developer figured out how to go buy older homes and took basically all those corners and was able to subdivide those into two. The advantage to that is they're still part of the fabric of that neighborhood, right? The most people wouldn't have realized, you know, driving through that had been an original lot that was larger. Still had to meet the density requirements, all of that. We've had not many, but a few examples of people who have bought several existing homes and have figured out how to have a private drive or some other street because it's access from a corner. And we've had those approvals. One of them didn't end up building, but there is a way to take to your Lucas Lane example, to go into a neighborhood and get more than one or two lots to then create a new cul-de-sac or some other street that connects and still meets all the zoning requirements of a subdivision.
So, I mean, something like this
is way more desirable.
Oh, I agree. But it can happen.
Mm-hmm.
Whether we offer flag lots or not.
Well, I'm just saying.
I mean, the fact that we offer flag lots would not say this couldn't happen.
But it's less likely to happen.
I think we set ourselves up for trouble if we're an outlier. If we're the only city in Salt Lake County that doesn't allow flag lots.
Would we be the only one that does not allow flag lots?
I'm not sure about the entire county, but out of all of the examples and kind of surrounding cities in the southwestern part of the valley that I looked at, we would be the only one.
I don't have a problem with that.
You're okay to be an outlier.
Have been my whole life.
Nothing new.
See me at appraisal meetings? Yeah.
Does the council like the legislative option? Assuming that the council, that we can find regulations that the council is okay with, do you still want these brought forward to you in a legislative setting? Or, like other things, do we put forward the rules and have it be administrative so that the rules are clear? There's not a question about things like development agreements and multiple hearings on one lot. I hope my question didn't show my bias.
Yeah, I think we know. I think we know.
Well, the way to adapt to that would be just charge a full fee so we recoup the time it takes.
Sure. We didn't come into this with one thing or the other. We can improve the flag lot floating zone. We can get rid of it in favor of a beefed up administrative process, or we can get rid of flag lots.
I mean, you know, these city council meetings, when we go to stuff, are very emotional, very emotional meetings, you know, for the people that show up. It's, you know, for the people that are selling it, the people who live around there. Almost every single scenario, it's long-term residents who've lived there on these larger lots. And It's a very emotional thing. They, you know, and all of a sudden, when they think that they all of a sudden, hey, we could have this many properties that all turn into rentals, that changes it pretty significantly as well. But I don't like, one thing I don't like about it is I don't like that we're trying to figure out what each one of these looks like and we're putting all the terms and parameters around it. I honestly prefer probably this as administrative, you know. But I think we put some guidelines on it. And my guideline that I recommend is that if we're going to do one, it's deed restricted for sale. You know, I don't think if they want to do a rental, that's an ADU in my opinion. You know, I don't think that
just take that course.
Yeah, take that course. If we're doing a flag lot, I think it's deed restricted for sale, you know, And then if we want to say, you know, further from that, that, you know, there can be no, you know, ADUs on these flag lots administratively, I could get okay with that. But I don't like having to go in there and in that very emotional environment, having to go in there and make all those decisions, you know, on the spot. I'd rather have it be like all these other cities. I'd rather have these cities just be have to be administrative and say, this is what you can expect on a flag lot. Here's the parameters. Here's what you can expect. If you want some rentals, then you better look at, you need to go the ADU route. And that's my personal take on it.
But would we be able to restrict it from having ADUs?
Or put it in the ordinance.
External right now, yes.
Yeah.
Internal, no, as long as it's a primarily residential zone, which most of these would be. External may change this session. But from what I'm hearing, and just have to watch it, we could still require owner-occupied. We could still require at least one off-site parking. That's what the internal ADUs are. And I don't know that they're combining an internal and an external, so there's two rentals, but I'm almost positive they would leave it with owner-occupied. That seems to be a line that the legislature's comfortable with. And so, I mean, that changes it from the scenario with flag lot. Even if they allowed both an internal and external, that could still be less than if you flag lot it and both of them have an ADU of some type. Then it's 3 versus 4.
But I think you get one or the other. You either get a flag lot or you get an external ADU. I think it's one or the other.
And right now,
and they can just choose which path they want to go.
And right now we could draft it that way unless some changes with legislation.
Yeah, well, and, you know, it's safe to say over time, over decades, we're just going to have more and more pressure for more and more density, you know, because we have limited land and a growing population. It's just going to happen over time. So I think we have to just say, okay, where are we today? And what's acceptable to our residents today, you know?
Well, if we're going to go that route, I don't think flag lots to the residents is acceptable.
That's fair. Yeah. Unless you're the one,
unless you're
proposing
the one trying
it.
To propose it.
Yeah.
I think in many cases you have, I mean, it seems like we get a lot of these, and it's not always the case, but I think a lot of them is like, you know, you have someone that has a house and they have a family member that needs a home, and instead of doing an accessory dwelling unit, they want to give them their own owned home,
a piece of land,
and I know it's, I don't think we can restrict it that tightly where we have to say it has to be sold to a family member.
No, how would we ever police that?
Yeah, I think, and I'm not proposing it, but I think we're starting to see people where they do have some bigger land and. You know, Don Shelton's got a really nice backyard. That'd be fantastic.
I don't have the 125 foot frontage. Though.
I was gonna say, don't you have
I've already
rock?
Gone through that calculation.
But
on the hill, you could do a hobo.
Yeah.
The other pending application is exactly that scenario,
uh-huh.
And it's the Pearsons who brought rise to the flag lot floating zone,
yeah.
Where they want to build a house, their own house, behind their parents' home currently, and obviously things can change in the future, but that is the story you will hear from many.
Well, we had a flag lot that would allow them to do it, and then we got rid of flag lots, and they came and asked the council, and that's why we have a legislative
yep.
process.
Yeah.
The council said, well, we want to be able to weigh these, and so we've given that to you, and here we are.
But when we get into those individual emotional situations, right?
Yeah.
It's hard. And so there is advantages to just creating rules that evenly apply to all and don't create ambiguity and pressure on the council at the time to approve something that they may not be comfortable in all situations.
Well, I mean, is the council okay with it's one or the other? You either have an ADU or you have a flag lot. And if you're going to do a flag lot, it's got to be owner occupied. And if they're looking for rental, then they need to go the ADU route. I mean,
I'm comfortable with that line of thinking.
Yeah.
I'm not comfortable with being the outlier and just saying no flag lots. Even though I totally agree with your point, I do agree with you completely. I think it's better to just redevelop a bigger piece of land, you know. But then I think we could make it administrative if we dial down the regulations enough, and maybe we need to have staff come back and say, hey, here are the restrictions that we propose, and then it's all on the planning commission. They get all the heat instead of us.
I mean, it doesn't even necessarily have to go to the planning commission. It could be staff level approval, but we can get into those details. I think your discussion, at least from my standpoint, was really helpful, and thanks to Joe for kind of teeing up getting some options out there. Even if we brought you an administrative procedure, an administrative option, it could be tied into the floating zone. If you still felt like we needed the floating zone, we could take out some of those provisions, put them as an upfront expectation before you come to council. You have to meet the following, but if you're okay, it sounds like the legislative.
Because the administrative, we have one.
We would just tweak it and bring that back. And then if you felt uncomfortable, we could fold it back into the floating zone to make you more.
If we kept a floating zone, I'd want us to have like the checklist so they have to hit these things before they even have a chance of having us hear the floating zone.
It sounds like
you'd be uncomfortable with ADUs in a flag lot floating zone.
Yes,
I think it's one or the other.
It seems like when you think about it from a legislative perspective, it seems like it is such a huge amount of work for staff and council and planning commission for such a small development.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And so if we're going to keep that legislative process, I think we definitely have to revisit the fees on that. I hate the idea of us having to go through all the work of the development agreement and all that, and for such a small development.
I'm amazed at how many residents show up over such a small piece of land. We've seen that in a couple situations recently.
Well, it's their home.
Well, but
around there,
just it doesn't take much. It doesn't seem like a lot. But that's the reason I'm thinking it's just like, hey, we'll just keep it very restrictive. Here's the parameters. I personally prefer that it's administrative, you know, and save everyone the headache and just say, you know, you're going to have to, and these parameters you put around are us saying, hey, we understand that, you know, that you have a bigger lot and you want to do something with it, but we're also taking into consideration all your neighbors and around there. And I just don't want to see this come back before the planning commission and the council anymore.
But then you're denying those neighbors of having their opportunity to say something about it.
Right. That's true.
You know, they may have some very valid points, and I think that it'll even make them angrier.
Yeah, we'll hear about it anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just...
So the
I mean, point, I agree with it, you, but I just think from their point of view.
It is a valid point what you're saying. Yeah.
So the 2x the size still requires a subdivision. And right now, all subdivisions go to the Planning Commission. So if we restricted flag lot subdivisions to staff, that would be the exception to our larger subdivision, preliminary subdivision process, which goes before the Planning Commission. And again, we can address all of that and look at it, but just so you understand the process, if you have one of those lots that's 2x the average size in the subdivision, in the existing subdivision, you still have to go to the Planning Commission to get subdivision approval. And we've had some of those where, you know, neighbors are uncomfortable. The difference is there's no discretion there if you meet the rules.
Yeah, so the neighbors can speak to it, and this is what frustrates people, they get invited to speak.
Yes.
But yet, if the application
the planning
meets
commission
the rules,
can't turn it down.
The planning commission must approve it.
Yeah.
Sometimes we get compromises where a future homeowner doesn't want to, you know, start off their time in the neighborhood ticking off all the neighbors. So if they hear something that they can implement, they'll implement it. So there may be some value that way, but on the whole, we see what Ryan just said is that it's more frustrating than helpful to kind of have your day to voice your concerns before a body that ultimately says, sorry, our hands are tied.
And that's why state law allows us not to have public comment and public notice in all instances of subdivision site plan. We've chosen to keep that in place, and that's a council decision, but we don't have to.
I just don't like the, I get the point that gives people opportunity to come. I just don't like the subjectivity, you know, that okay, if they have a large enough emotional plea, then we are going to arbitrarily do something in that community versus someone else who doesn't show up as with a much emotional plea, and we're going to do something different. That's where I kind of run into some of the issues. I don't necessarily disagree with everything that was in that meeting we had, we were discussing. I don't necessarily disagree with some of the things that were requested. I just don't want to be going in there and making all those decisions. I'd rather just have us evaluate, hey, here's what we allow in a flag lot. Here's what you can expect. I think in general, I mean, just build a traditional home, there's certain expectations with a normal lot. You know, it's like, here's what you have, and the same thing with the regular flag lot. This is what it is, and this is what you have to work with, period. That's just my thought.
Mayor Pro Tem, we're approaching 6:30 now.
Okay. So, do you have a motion?
Motion to adjourn.
A second.
All in favor?
Aye.